Good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure to be with you. We want to, again, welcome those who are visiting with us. Especially, we want you to feel as if you are our honored guest, because that is how we regard you. And in fact, if you are here visiting with us for the very first time, we would appreciate it very much if you would take just a moment and fill out a visitor's card and give that to one of the members after services. We'd love to have a record of your visit, but glad you are with us. The Old Testament books of Exodus and Numbers talk about the trek of the Israelites out of Egyptian bondage and down into the Sinai Peninsula, and then that period of time that ultimately was 40 years in length, where they were living as nomadic people in that wilderness of Sinai. Numbers chapter 13 begins a discussion of the Israelites after they have left Mount Sinai, having received God's law, having received the instructions about the tabernacle, that God might then dwell with them, so to speak, in the promised land. And they've made their way up the Sinai Peninsula to the area of Kadesh Barnea, which was an oasis there in that desert region. And it was on the southern border, so to speak, of the land of Canaan. And so it is at this point in Numbers chapter 13 that we begin to read these words. I'd like to read several verses here and talk about what happens. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Send out for yourself men so that they may spy out the land of Canaan, which I am going to give to the sons of Israel. You shall send a man from each of their father's tribes, every one a leader among them." So Moses sent them from the wilderness of Paran at the command of the Lord. All of them were heads of the sons of Israel. Verse 25 continues. When they returned from spying out the land at the end of 40 days, they proceeded to come to Moses and Aaron and to all the congregation of the sons of Israel in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh. And they brought back word to them and all the congregation and showed them the fruit of the land. Thus they told him and said, "We went into the land where you sent us, and it certainly does flow with milk and honey. And this is its fruit. Nevertheless, the people who live in the land are strong, and the cities are fortified and very large. And moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there. Amalek is living in the land of the Negev, and the Hittites and Jebusites and the Amorites are living in the hill country, and the Canaanites are living by the sea and by the side of the Jordan." Then Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, "We should by all means go up and take possession of it, for we shall surely overcome it." But the men who had gone up with him said, "We are not able to go up against the people, for they are too strong for us." So they gave out to the sons of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, "The land through which we have gone in spying it out is a land that devours its inhabitants. And all the people whom we saw in it are men of great size. There also we saw the Nephilim. The sons of Anak are part of the Nephilim. And we became like grasshoppers in our own sight. And so we were in their sight." Then all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried out, and the people wept that night. And all the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron. And the whole congregation said to them, "Would that we had died in the land of Egypt, or would that we had died in the wilderness. And why is the Lord bringing us into this land to fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become plunder. Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt?" So they said to one another, "Let us appoint a leader and return to Egypt." Then Moses and Aaron fell on their faces in the presence of all the assembly of the congregation of the sons of Israel. And Joshua the son of Nun and Caleb the son of Jephunneh, of those who had spied out the land, tore their clothes. And they spoke to all the congregation of the sons of Israel, saying, "The land which we pass through to spy out is an exceedingly good land. If the Lord is pleased with us, then he will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land that flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Lord, and do not fear the people of the land, for they shall be our prey. Their protection has been removed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them. But all the congregation said to stone them with stones. Then the glory of the Lord appeared in the tent of meeting to all the sons of Israel. I will pause there in the reading. But I think you can see what a dramatic incident this is in the history of God's Old Testament people. Here is a people who have been brought out of Egypt by the hand of Almighty God through great power, through great miracles, great wonders. And God had protected them through the wilderness. And here is a people who now see all the goodness of the land that God had promised, a land indeed that was flowing with milk and honey. Everything God had said about that was just right on target. But 10 of these 12 spies give a report that says, let's not even bother going in. We can't take those people. You know, the mission of these spies was never a mission to determine whether or not they could conquer the Canaanites. That wasn't the purpose of this. That wasn't the nature of their spy mission. Their mission as spies was to reconnoiter. Their mission as spies was to go into this land and check out the lay of the land and the topography of the land and where the roads were, because this was an area where the Israelites had never been before. Their mission was to go and to observe all these things about the fortified cities and the nature of the fortifications so that they would just know the best way to go in and to travel as they went in to conquer the land. It was never a spy mission to determine whether or not it was a feasible operation. God had already determined that. God had already said, I will conquer these people for you and give you this land. But instead, what you see these spies, at least 10 of the spies, doing is showing a lack of faith in God and then encouraging the other people to say, let's go back to Egypt. We can't do this. There are several lessons that come to my mind when I look at these two chapters, these two powerful chapters in the book of Numbers. And I don't have time this morning to talk about all the lessons that we can learn from these chapters, but I will talk about just a few that especially strike me. When I read these chapters, certainly what I see in chapter 14, when the glory of God appears in the tent of meeting, and when he then begins to talk with Moses about what these spies have said and about what the people have now been influenced to decide to do, what I'm struck with so forcefully is the absolute wrath of God that you see in these verses. In verse 11 of chapter 14, the text says, the Lord said to Moses, how long will this people spurn me? And how long will they not believe in me, despite all the signs which I have performed in their midst? I will smite them with pestilence and dispossess them. And I will make you into a nation greater and mightier than they. But Moses said to the Lord, then the Egyptians will hear of it, for by thy strength thou dost bring up this people from their midst. And they will tell it to the inhabitants of this land. They have heard that thou, O Lord, art in the midst of this people, for thou, O Lord, art seen eye to eye while thy cloud stands over them, and thou dost go before them in a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. Now if thou dost slay this people as one man, then the nations who have heard of thy fame will say, because the Lord could not bring this people into the land which he promised them by oath, therefore he slaughtered them in the wilderness. But now, I pray, let the power of the Lord be great just as thou hast declared. The Lord is slow to anger and abundant in loving kindness, forgiving iniquity and transgression, but he will by no means leave the guilty unpunished, visiting the iniquity of the fathers and the children to the third and fourth generation. Pardon, I pray, the iniquity of this people, according to the greatness of thy loving kindness, just as thou also hast forgiven this people from Egypt even until now. So the Lord said, I have pardoned them according to your word. But indeed, as I live, all the earth will be filled with the glory of the Lord. Surely all the men who have seen my glory and my signs, which I performed in Egypt and in the wilderness, yet have put me to the test these 10 times and have not listened to my voice, they shall by no means see the land which I swore to their fathers, nor shall any of those who spurned me see it. I'm overwhelmed by the wrath of God in this passage. In fact, what you see in this passage is a depiction of Moses pleading with God in the same way that we can imagine two human beings where there's one human being trying to pacify another who is just so angry, and another human being trying to calm them down. That's the depiction you see here. In this case, it's Moses, in a sense, trying to calm God down and please beg him to be merciful. In fact, that kind of surprises people, I think, sometimes. I've had people say to me in this and other occasions where Moses is almost trying to talk with God and just keep God from doing something rash. And it seems to me that what you see in all this, there is some accommodation here. I think God is accommodating himself to the perspective of human beings. And he's purposely allowing Moses to placate his wrath. But the purpose in all that is just to make it so clear how angry. He is furious. He is angry. His wrath is kindled at these people. And their absolute lack of faith, despite all the miracles that they had seen, and now they had the audacity to say that this God who brought them out of mighty Egypt is not somehow powerful enough to give them the land of Canaan and dispossess those Canaanite people. How dare they treat God that way? And he's absolutely angry. There's a lesson there, folks. Do we appreciate the nature of the wrath of God? Do we really? I know so often we want to go to those Bible passages to talk about God as a God of love. We want the preacher to be sure and preach on those passages about God being the God of love. We want to make sure that when we come to worship services that we are encouraged and we feel good and made to feel how good we are, that we have a relationship with God. And all that has a place. All that has a place. But let me tell you what also has a place. And that's understanding the absolute wrath of God at sin. At people who receive the blessings of God over and over and over again, and don't serve him, don't trust him. In fact, rely upon their own understanding and say, well, this is the truth, or this is the reality, and here's what Almighty God has said, and yet what he said doesn't matter. We know better. That absolutely infuriates God. And that's how the Bible depicts him. And this incident here with Moses trying to pacify him, one of several occasions in the wilderness where Moses is having to pacify the wrath of God, it's purposely presented in that way just to show us how absolutely angry God gets at sin. Hebrews 10 verse 30 says, we know him who said, vengeance is mine, I will repay. And again, the Lord will judge his people. It is a terrifying thing to fall into the hands of the living God. Is that the way we feel? Do we really appreciate the wrath of God? Do we see it as a terrifying thing when we commit sin? Or have we become so jaded by our society? Have we become so affected by biblical teaching about God's mercy and God's love that that's all we consider when we think about God? Oh, well, Jesus died for me. He'll forgive me. Is that our attitude about sin? Sure seems to me that we need to have a different attitude when we look at these biblical depictions of God when His wrath is kindled at sin. In fact, when you think about what is being said, not just in this passage, but also in a passage like Isaiah 63, do you want a graphic illustration of God in His judicial wrath? I can think of no more powerful one than Isaiah 63. Where here the prophet in this vision sees God, and the garments that he's wearing, they're stained with something red, something on them. It looks like the garments of someone who has been treading the wine trough when they would use their feet to then stomp the grapes in the trough, and the grapes, the juice would splatter up on their garments. Well, that's what it looks like on the garments of Yahweh as Isaiah sees him in this vision. But it's not the juice of the grape that stains his garments. Verse 3 says, I have trodden the wine trough. I also trod them in my anger and trampled them in my wrath. He's talking about the people of Israel. Their lifeblood is sprinkled on my garments, and I stained all my raiment. For the day of vengeance was in my heart. I trod down the peoples in my anger and made them drunk in my wrath, and I poured out their lifeblood on the earth. You want a gruesome picture there? He's really depicting the scene of a battlefield with all these corpses and the blood that has come forth from all those wounds and these corpses. And what he says is, okay, this may have been an earthly battle, but really what it is God just came and stomped on all of them, and their blood spurted and stained his garments, and that's what this is depicting. That's pretty gruesome. But that's the judicial wrath of God. And the Bible is trying to somehow get us to appreciate that God is a God who will not, in fact cannot, just tolerate sin and just overlook it. In fact, this statement in Numbers 14 and verse 20, in the midst of the discussion that Yahweh is having with Moses, the text says in verse 20, the Lord said, or rather verse 21, indeed, as I live, all the earth will be filled with the glory of the Lord. And if you really appreciate what God is saying there, He's talking as a God who has been spurned by His creation from the very beginning. In fact, when the Israelites come out of Egypt, as we've talked about in some previous lessons, it is a period in the history of the world where the world and its nations have lost a knowledge of the Creator God. Don't even know who He is. Haven't heard of Him. Oh, there's these other man-made deities. They're all worshipped, all these nature deities. But the God who has made heaven and earth, people don't even know who He is. And here are these people of Israel, whom He has identified Himself to as the God of their forefathers. He has delivered them from Egyptian bondage with a mighty hand. And then they are the ones who are acting as if He's not a God to be trusted, not a God to be served. Yahweh says to Moses, indeed, as I live. Like, that's a way of giving an oath. He's swearing by Himself. As Hebrews 6 says, there's no one greater whom God can swear by. So what's He do when He wants to swear something? He swears by Himself, hoping that'll make an impression upon human beings. He says, indeed, as I live, by my own immortality, I swear this. all the earth will be filled with the glory of the Lord. One way or another, I'm going to be glorified. I'm not going to be ignored, he says. I'm not going to be spurned. I'm not going to overlook this kind of behavior. One way or another, I will be glorified. And that's an angry God. That's a wrathful God who is talking. And I want to tell you what, folks, we need to understand that's who we're talking about here. And as we look at our own lives individually, we need to all feel that sense of my sin against this God and my years of ignoring Him and my years of doing what I wanted to do and not trusting in Him and not trusting in His Word, putting Him off. Maybe I'll become a Christian at some point. Maybe I will, but in the meantime, I'll do my own thing. All those kinds of attitudes. This is a wrathful God. And His promise is, I will not put up with this indefinitely. All my glory will fill all the earth. I think it's a powerful and needful lesson that we get from Numbers 13 and 14. And I'll tell you something else that strikes me when I look at this whole incident of the spies. It's the influence. The influence for evil that just a handful of people had. Doesn't that strike you? The influence of just a very few people. It was just 10 people who gave this bad report and stirred up the entire mob of how many thousands? Numbers 14, verse 36 says, as for the men whom Moses sent to spy out the land and who returned and made all the congregation grumble against him by bringing out a bad report concerning the land, even those men who brought out the very bad report of the land died by a plague before the Lord. Here's this judgment of God coming upon them. They were all slain by means of that plague. But notice the language of verse 36. Those were men who, when they returned, they, so to speak, made all the congregation grumble. They made them do that. Well, how did they make them grumble against God? With their words, they influenced them. When their words, they said something that was the opposite of what God had revealed about the Canaanites falling before the forces of Israel, they said, no, that won't happen. And so by their words, they influenced so many. And as a result, that entire generation that came out of Egypt, the entire generation of adults who came out of Egypt, with the exception of Joshua and Caleb, the two spies, the only two who gave a good report of faith in God. All the rest, they died in the wilderness. Spent 40 years wandering in the wilderness, and that's where their bodies lay. You know, it really is shocking the impact that just a few people can have for bad upon other people. In Galatians chapter 5, the Apostle Paul writes these words to the churches of Galatia, congregations that he had established, he and Barnabas, on their first missionary journey. Churches like Antioch of Pisidia, Iconium, Lystra, Derbe, these churches in the province of Galatia, and now they have been influenced to accept some kind of doctrine, a perverted form of the gospel of Jesus that Paul and Barnabas never preached to them. Paul says this in Galatians 5, verse 7. You were running well. Who hindered you from obeying the truth? This persuasion did not come from him who calls you. A little leaven leavens the whole lump of dough. Then Paul goes on to say, I have confidence in you, in the Lord, that you will adopt no other view, but the one who is disturbing you shall bear his judgment, whoever he is. Paul doesn't even know who the individual is who has infiltrated those churches of Galatia. Somebody has come in and has been teaching them that those Gentiles don't just need to believe in Jesus and follow him. Instead, they need to be circumcised and become Jews in order to be saved. And that has had influence upon those in those congregations of Galatia. Paul doesn't know who the individual is, but my point to you is, and apparently it's just some individual. It's amazing how just a few people, sometimes only one person, can have a negative impact upon so many of God's people. So when you think about that, you think about the incident here in Numbers 14, the influence of just a few people. Let me ask you this question. Who are you allowing to influence you? Who influences you? We live in a day and time where you turn on the TV and here are these televangelists. Or people knock on your door and they come to your door and they have various views that they want to present. Who are you allowing to influence you? The Bible teaches it could just be maybe just a few people, just a handful of people can have a dramatic influence, a negative one, on so many of God's people. It might even just be one individual. You know, when you're listening to those people, if you ever watch, I don't encourage you, but if you do watch those televangelists, let me just say something to you. When you're watching someone who doesn't even understand what the Bible teaches one needs to do to be saved, he doesn't get that accurately. Do you really think that there's going to be a lot of trustworthy things he's going to say about a lot of other things? Oh, but he says a lot of good things, or she says a lot of good things about such and such. But do you think if they don't even understand what to do to be saved, do you not think there could be some negative influence upon you with other things that you're listening to that they have to say? Maybe sometimes some things you don't even realize. Or another example. If those people who come to your door, if they think that there's some latter-day revelation, whether it's to Joseph Smith or whoever else, if they think there's some kind of latter-day revelation and that's in clear contradiction to what the Bible is teaching, do you really think that those people are going to be a good influence upon you in regard to these other things that they're going to be teaching? Look at all the things that we now have available to us on the internet. We live in a generation where people get their information not from going to a church library, even though we're trying to get that fixed up for people. But that's not where most people get their information now. Where people get most of their religious information now is Google search. Bing, just, you know, whatever. All the search engines, and so whatever pops up, and that's what they read. And so often people are not in a position to really know the wheat from the chaff. Who are you allowing to influence you? Those are some questions we need to really think about. And as you're thinking about that, think about what's God's attitude about the people whom you're allowing to influence you, and what's God's attitude about you allowing yourself to be influenced by that kind of false teaching. And remember, as Numbers 14 reminds us, we're dealing with a God who's tired of his people rejecting what he says for what some human being says. So who are you allowing to influence you? That's a good question we need to ask ourselves. And I'll give you one final lesson that I think we can learn from all this. It's really something that to me is the most amazing part of this entire two chapters. Numbers 14, beginning with verse 20, gives the Lord's final statement after allowing himself to be persuaded by Moses to show mercy here. He's not going to slay everybody outright, slay the 10 spies who gave the bad report. But he's going to let the rest of the people live. They're not going to go in the promised land, though. The Lord said, verse 20, I have pardoned them according to your word, but indeed, as I live, All the earth will be filled with the glory of the Lord. Surely all the men who have seen my glory and my signs, which I perform in Egypt and in the wilderness, yet have put me to the test these 10 times and have not listened to my voice, shall by no means see the land I swore to their fathers. Now that's what God says, and that's what Moses delivers to the people. It's what is said next in the text that just amazes me. In fact, some people aren't even really aware of this being in the passage. Look at what happens next. When Moses spoke these words to all the sons of Israel, the people mourned greatly. In the morning, however, they rose up early and went up to the ridge of the hill country, saying, "Here we are. We have indeed sinned, but we will go up to the place which the Lord has promised." Excuse me? What are they saying? God's just said, "Now I'm not going to let you go into that land," and now you're saying, "Okay, we're sorry. Okay, now we're going to go in the land." That's what these people do. But Moses, verse 41, Moses said, "Why then are you transgressing the commandment of the Lord when it will not succeed?" But they don't listen to him. And the text says they marched straight up north into that territory, and the Ark of the Covenant wasn't with them. Yahweh wasn't with them. And guess what the Canaanites did? They slaughtered. You know what lesson we learn from this? We need to learn from this. Pardon is on God's terms. It's always on God's terms. Not our terms. And sometimes there are consequences of the sins that we commit. Those have to be accepted. There are consequences. But here are Israelite people. They don't want any consequences. They want God's pardon, but they want it on their terms. In fact, they acknowledge that they sinned. It's not that they weren't admitting it. They were upset by the announcement of God and all this. And they said, "We have sinned." But they think, okay, well, the way for us to handle this is, okay, God, okay, all right, we'll go up. Okay. And God was saying, "Don't bother now, because you're not entering in that land now. Not after what you've done." And they said, "Oh, okay, no. We're going to go on. Come on. We'll go conquer the Canaanites." That's not the way it works. Pardon, folks, is on God's terms. And the consequences of sin, you just have to accept. There's a lot of people in our day and time. They like what God says about forgiveness of sins. And to a certain extent, they do mourn their sins. Just like the people of Israel here. To a certain extent, they acknowledge that their sins and they mourn their sins. But they don't want to have pardon in the way that God's word says pardon can be received. They want to have pardon a different way. A way that conforms to their thinking, to their tradition, to what they would like. And so what one needs to do to be saved, a lot of people just have some different teaching on that and they adopt some different teaching on that. Jesus said to believe and be baptized in order to be saved. And yet a lot of people in our day, they want pardon on a different basis. They don't want to have to do it God's way. Or there's a lot of people who they don't want to have to really repent in order to receive God's pardon. They want to still be able to live the lifestyle that they have previously lived. They might make a change here or there, but basically they want to live the way they want to live and not make the changes God says that they need to make. And yet people still want God and expect God to be with them. As if pardon is on their terms. Or as I said before, some people just want to receive God's pardon and have none of the consequences. And what you see here is the lesson that, no, that's not the way it works. Again, we're talking about God being God and us as human beings accepting God's will and God's authority over our lives. Powerful, powerful lessons here in Numbers 13 and 14. Now, there are some bright spots in this set of verses. There's some positive things in these verses, some good lessons that we can also learn from this of a positive nature. I want to talk about some of those tonight. So I hope you can be back with us. Thank you so much for being here. Those of you, again, who are visiting with us, we're glad that you're here. And I hope that what we've been able to do this morning is to focus our minds upon some serious things about God that we learn from these verses here and make the application in our own life. If you're here this morning and you need to respond to the gospel of Jesus Christ, we sure would love to help you do that. If you need to be baptized into Jesus, or if you are an erring Christian and in some other way we can assist you, please make that known to us and let us help you in whatever way that we can, while together we stand and sing this song of encouragement.